Chapter 13, chapter entitled Description of Future Manus. Verse 1. Shri Shuka Vacha Manur Vivasvata Putra Shraddha Deva Iti Shrutaha Saptamo Vartamano Yas Tadapatyanime Shrunu. Translation. Shukadeva Goswami said, the present Manu, who is named Shraddhadev, is the son of Vivasvan, the predominating deity of the sun planet. Shraddhadev is the seventh Manu. Now please hear from me as I describe his sons. Several verses, there are no purports. So I'll read the verses till we come to a verse with purport. O King Parikshit, among the 10 sons of Manu are Ikshvaku, Nabhaga, Drishta, Sharyati, Narishyanta and Nabhag. The seventh son is known as Dishta. Then come Tarusha and Pushadra. And the 10th son is known as Vasuman. In this Manvantara, O King, the Adityas, the Vasus, the Rudras, the Vishwadevas, the Maruts, the two Ashwin Kumar brothers and the Rubhus are the demigods. Their head king Indra is Purandara. Kashyap, Adri, Vashishtha, Vishwamitra, Gautama, Jamadagni, and Bharadwaj are known as the seven sages. In this Manvantara, the Supreme Personality of God had appeared as the youngest of all the Adityas, known as Vamana, the dwarf. His father was Kashyap and his mother Aditi. I have briefly explained to you the position of the seven Manus. Now I shall describe the future Manus, along with the incarnations of Lord Vishnu. O King, I have previously described in the sixth canto the two daughters of Vishwakarma, namely Sangya and Chaya, who were the first two wives of Vivasvan. It is said that the sun god had a third wife named Vadava. Of the three wives, the wife named Sangya had three children, Yama, Yami and Shraddhadev. Now let me describe the children of Chaya. Chaya had a son named Savarni and a daughter named Tapati, who later became the wife of King Samvarna. Chaya's third child is known as Shaneshchara, Saturn. Vadava gave birth to two sons, namely the Ashwini brothers. O King, when the period of the eighth Manu arrives, Savarni will become Manu, Nirmoka and Virajaksha will be among his sons. Purport. The present reign is that of Vaivasvat Manu. According to astronomical calculations, we are now in the 28th Yuga of Vaivasvat Manu. Each Manu lives for 71 Yugas and 14 such Manus rule in one day of Lord Brahma. But Shukadeva Goswami, having heard from authorities foretells that the 8th Manu will be Savarni, and that Nirmoka and Virajaksha will be among his sons. Shastras can foretell what will happen millions and millions of years in the future. I seek the blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas so that I can speak something for the glorification of the Lord, the purification of my filthy heart. Hare Krishna. So, in this chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Description of Future Manus, we see a remarkable worldview being described. We see a universe that is replete with life at all levels, is carefully administered by devatas at its various hierarchy levels. We have Manu, and then within him we have demigods, and above him we have Brahma and the other devatas. So this is a worldview which is dramatically different from what most people learn today in their educational systems. So in today's class, I'll talk about this worldviews. I'll discuss four main points. Do worldviews really matter? I believe something, I look at the world in a particular way, somebody else looks in another way. Does it really matter? Do worldviews really matter? And then we'll discuss what are the... Some people may say this is very fantastic. You believe there is a Manu and there is a sun god and there is So we'll look at what are the different predominant worldviews that are available in modern society, and we'll compare them. Then we will see, we will address some of the common challenges or criticisms of the Bhagavat worldview. And lastly, we will discuss about how we can imbibe this Bhagavat worldview in our own life at a more deeper level. So, when Srila Prabhupada met John Lennon and Yoko Ono, the first question Prabhupada asked them is, what philosophy do you believe? What philosophy do you follow? So their reply is typical of the reply of most modern people. They said, we don't follow any philosophy. We just live. We just live. So most people don't really think about the deeper truths of life, but just live. However, even when we say we just live, we are, without our conscious choice, without our conscious contemplation and decision, are accepting the worldview that is prevalent in society. So it is not that people don't have a philosophy. Everybody has a philosophy. Now, of course, some philosophies might be philosophies. Philosophy means the sophistry, the word jugglery of fools. But everybody has some sort of worldview. And that worldview does matter. So some materialistic people say that you believe that there is a God. But what difference does it make? You are going to die and we are going to die. But you are following so many rules and regulations and restricting yourself so much. What is the use of that? Ultimately, you are not going to be saved from death. You are also going to die. So in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in the Vishwarupa Darshan, Arjuna gets a very remarkable vision of all the warriors entering into the mouth of the Vishwarupa. And while describing that, two analogies are used. Yatha nadinam bhavam buvega and yatha pradeeptam jvalanam patanga. The first analogy describes as the rivers enter into the ocean. And yatha pradeeptam jvalanam patanga, as the moths enter into fire. So now, in that vision, in the Vishwarup, actually Arjuna sees that even the good and the evil are entering. Not only does he see the Kauravas entering, but he even sees Bhishma entering, Drona entering, and he also sees many of the warriors on his own side entering. Rute pitvam na bhavishyanti sarve. Rute pitvam, except for you, O Arjuna. You means you and the Pandavas. Everybody else will be destroyed. And that's what eventually happened. So good and evil both are destroyed. So if both good and evil are destroyed, what difference does it make? So Baldev Vidyabhushan, in his commentary to these verses, says that this analogy has a significance. He says that when a river flows into the ocean, it goes by its natural flow. Whereas when a moth enters into a fire, it is by its conscious choice. Now, one of the prominent acharyas in the Sri Sampradaya, after Ramacharya, is Vedanta Deshika. Now, he has written his tika on Ramacharya's Gita Bhashya. It's called Tatpari Chandrika. And in that, he elaborates the import of these two analogies further. He says that, first of all, when a moth enters into fire, the moth is destroyed. The moth was a living creature with a form and life, and it is reduced to ashes. Whereas, when a river enters into an ocean, the river is not destroyed, because the same material, the same water that was there in the river, continues to be there in the ocean. Another difference, he says, is that when a moth enters into the fire, it just destroys it. It just doesn't do any good to itself. It actually tries to attack and enjoy the fire, and it kills itself. On the other hand, when a river flows through the hills and then through the plateaus and then through the plains and then enters the ocean, then before entering the ocean, it does so much good to the world. It nourishes so many crops. It provides water to so many thirsty people. So like that, he says, even the godly people will eventually enter into death. But before they die, just as the river does so much good to the world, the godly people do so much good to the world. And thirdly, he says that actually when the moth tries to enter into the fire, the moth does not enter into the fire. The moth just comes in contact and burns and falls aside. Whereas when the river enters into the ocean, the river becomes a part of the river, ocean. So he says, similarly, when the devotees live spiritually in this world, they become a part of the spiritual nature of the Lord. As in the 18th chapter, 55th, 56th verses, Krishna talks about how Bhaktya mam vijanati yavanya shasmi tatvatha tato mam tatvato gyatva vishate tadanantaram. Vishanti, the word used over here is vishanti, there it is vishate. That, you know, it enters into. Now this entering is not a merging, it is like a green bird entering into a green forest. So actually a devotee attains the spiritual nature. And Vedanta Deshika further says that he takes this analogy of the ocean with the analogy in second chapter 2.70, where it says no matter how many rivers enter into an ocean, the ocean never gets full. Apuryamanam achala pratishtam. So he says, similarly, no matter how many devotees offer their love and service to Krishna, Krishna never becomes exhausted. Krishna never becomes saturated. Krishna can accept and reciprocate with the love of everyone. So, yes, in this world, everybody, whether one is a devotee or a non-devotee, whether one accepts a spiritual worldview or a materialistic worldview, everyone has to perish, at least at the bodily level. But there are two differences. One is how we live and how we benefit others in this life and what happens to us at the end of this life. So a devotee does good while he is here in this world and eventually he returns back to the eternal spiritual world where actually he is forever happy. Prabhupada writes in the 10th chapter of Bhagavata purport, he says this auspicious doesn't matter for a devotee, because for a devotee his future is supremely bright. He's going back to the spiritual world. So, yes, our worldviews will make a big difference in this life and in the next life. Now, today, there are, of course, there are unlimited worldviews, but the predominant worldviews are what is sponsored by the modern scientific education. It is materialistic, atheistic worldview. Then there is the impersonalistic, monistic worldview, which is predominant in Hinduism. And then there is the monotheistic worldview, which is there in religions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam. So let's briefly discuss them and then we'll come to the Bhagavat worldview. So the modern science has this idea that the only thing that is existing is matter. So even science is actually monism. Monism means there is only one substance that exists. Mono means one. So only one substance that exists. So there are spiritual monists and there are material monists. So the Mayavadis are spiritual monists and the scientists, at least the atheistic scientists, are material monists. They say the only thing that exists is matter. Matter is all that is. So Devamrit Maharaj, in Searching for Vedic India, says that scientists are devotees of matter. Everybody has to be devotee of someone. So they are devotees of matter. So now if we look at, generally when we start a Bhagavata course, we talk about the design argument. How we see the world is so systematically, intricately, delicately coordinated and harmonized. And therefore, it should have a designer. Which is quite a logical argument. But somehow, the way scientific history proceeded, science has actually rejected the idea of God. So basically, we use two arguments. One is that design requires a designer and law requires a lawmaker. However, these two are different arguments. And the law requires a lawmaker argument often weakens the design requires a designer argument. You see, before Newton, whether it was India, in the West or in the East, practically most people believed in God. And Newton himself was a believer in God. In fact, when Newton was dying, when he was asked what is the greatest achievement of your life, you know, he had done so many remarkable inventions, but he said on his deathbed, the greatest achievement of my life was that I remained a celibate throughout my life. Now we don't learn this in our textbooks, that even Newton was a celibate, and in fact the later part of his life he spent as a monk in a church. So he was strongly devoted to God, and his idea was that when he would make his inventions, he would say, "Oh God, I think thy thoughts after thee." That means the way you have created this world, I'm understanding it now. So for him, his scientific discoveries were like spiritual revelations of God's glory. However, when he discovered that the world is being operated by laws, that the planets are moving, not just because there is a God making them move, it is because they are moving by gravity. So this led to, without Newton's intention like that, this led to a promotion of the materialistic worldview. Because if everything is operating according to a law, then there is no need for a designer. Just like if there is a lump of clay, and the lump of clay we make into a nicely carved pot. So that design requires a designer. But if we could determine a law by which, okay, you put the lump of clay in a machine, turn it like this, turn it like that, press it like this, squeeze it like this, pull it like this, and a pot comes out. So if we can make a mechanical law for determining how the design will come out, then the law will result in the design. And there is no need for a designer. So of course, the law will require a lawmaker. That's a different argument. But the point is that if there is a law, then there is no need for design. Designer specifically, to bring about the design. The law itself will bring about. So from the time of Newton, atheism started coming up. And when Darwin came up, Prabhupada was so strongly critical of Darwin because Darwin said that even the laws can come by themselves. The laws can come by themselves. So whether in the West or the East, there was originally the idea that God is creator and controller. But when Newton came, so that is called as theism. When Newton came along, the idea became that God is the creator, but not the controller. It's just like we have a watch here. The watch is obviously made by somebody, but that manufacturer of the watch does not have any control over the watch. So there's a creator for the watch, but there's no controller for them. The creator is not the controller, because the watch is operating according to laws. So similarly, what happened was, the idea that came in is that if everything is operating according to laws, there is no need for a controller. So that is called as deism. Then after that, when Newton, Darwin came along, he said there is no need for God as a creator also. Why? Because evolution can create everything. And in this way, God was completely exiled. Exiled from the academic world. So now the current idea is that, why do you want to bring God into the picture? Let's make everything understandable according to laws. Because why? If we can make everything understandable according to laws, then we can understand those laws, we can control those laws, and maybe we can make our own laws. And basically, we can take the place of God. That is the agenda of modern science. Now, Srila Prabhupada gives a brilliant example to illustrate the flaw of this analogy. Yes, nature may be operating according to laws, but just the laws are not enough. Not only do we need a lawmaker, we need a law overseer. Now, if the laws could operate automatically, I'm sure every government in the world would be very interested to know how the laws operate automatically. Laws need an overseer. So, just like if we write a computer code, and then the machine runs according to computer code. So, there has to be a person to write the program. And secondly, there has to be always somebody to debug the programs. You know, because no matter how well the program is written, bugs come in. In fact, because computers have bugs, people have jobs. Isn't it? So, actually, there is a maintainer required. But what happens is, as scientists are devotees of matter, they try to explain everything in terms of matter, and when they come to consciousness, when they come over, there is a person who has life, he has consciousness, he can perceive. They start thinking, okay, how can this consciousness come from matter? But this itself is a wrong question. Prabhupada gives the example that suppose somebody has been living in darkness throughout his life, and he has never come to know what is light. And he's moving around in darkness and making a mess of falling on people, falling on things, stumbling and bruising himself. And suddenly he comes to light. Now what is the question he asks? How did this darkness produce the light? How did the darkness produce the light? Now the fact is that darkness did not produce light. Rather it was light that by its absence produced darkness. But because of being accustomed to living in darkness, the question that comes in the mind is,
How did darkness produce light? Similarly, scientists who live in the world of matter, when they come to consciousness, how did matter produce consciousness? That's why Prabhupada said life comes from life. Life does not come from matter. So, yes, nature may be operating according to laws, but the operation of nature according to laws is as we in mathematics, we have a necessary but not sufficient condition. Just like if somebody is standing on a road outside a house and looking at a garage, and suddenly a car starts coming out of the garage, and you start going backwards. Okay, why did this car start moving? Oh, because the wheels were moving. Okay, but why were the wheels moving? Oh, there's a mechanism connected with the wheels which caused it to move. Okay, but why did the mechanism start moving? Oh, because there was a spark in the ignition. But why was there a spark in the ignition? Oh, because the key was in the vertical position, that meant to the horizontal position. Yes, that is why the car started. Now, it's a correct explanation, but it's a disastrously incomplete explanation. Because there is a person who moved the key. Isn't it? So, like that, modern science does trace backwards. But it stops at a particular time. As soon as it comes to matter, it will go only to the scope of matter and it doesn't go to spirit or consciousness or life. It tries to explain everything in terms of matter. And the result of this is disastrous. Because if everything is matter, when a mother sees a child or a child sees the mother, what are the emotions of love? Oh, they are just some biochemical secretions in the brain. If they are just biochemical secretions in the brain, then if a person becomes angry and kills someone, actually this happens in America in the law courts, say, yeah, it's in my genes. In my genes, I get angry. So don't blame me, blame my genes. And many times in the law cases, if a person is proved to be criminal and you cannot get him out, then you get a certificate from a psychiatrist that his genes are like that. And instead of him being punished in a jail, he is moved to a mental asylum. So, now all of us understand that there is a sense of responsibility. Our genes may push us to behave in a particular way, but they don't control us. They push us, but they don't control us. They prompt us, but we can resist their prompting. But the point is, the scientific worldview can lead to disaster. As Martin Luther King predicted, we have guided missiles and misguided men. Misguided men. Because we are able to control matter, we are not able to control spirit at all. As Srila Prabhupada went to the West, and he would say, what is the use of your big technology? You build skyscrapers, and then people climb on the skyscrapers and jump down and commit suicide. So what is the use? Yeah, so science has had tremendous success, but it's a very lopsided, partial success, where we understand matter a lot and we don't understand consciousness at all. And that's why everywhere in the world, people are turning towards more holistic worldviews, more complete worldviews. Actually, science developed not so much because science could explain things, but it developed more because religion at that time could not explain things. So the Judeo-Christian worldview, which was present at the time of the advent of science, actually was very incomplete in its explanation. Recently, when I had gone for a preaching tour to South India, in the train, one Christian preacher came to preach to me. He said, I want to save you. I want to save you from going to hell. So I had an interesting talk. So he said, we are having a discussion. So I started Prabhupada's standard argument. He said, the commandment says, thou shalt not kill. He says, oh, that refers only to humans. He says, why? Because animals don't have any soul. Oh, really? But animals have consciousness. How do they have consciousness? Oh, they have spirit, they don't have soul. That is their idea. They have spirit, but they don't have soul. Oh, really? Okay. But what is the difference between spirit and soul? The Prabhupada is a simple argument. All the symptoms that we have, now we feel pain, we respond to stimuli, we cherish our loved ones, we treasure life. All these are there in animals. Just no. Actually, the spirit is something which is very intangible and subtle. Now if you see what originally Jesus taught in the New Testament is mostly moral codes and parables. Jesus did not teach much philosophy. So the idea that animals don't have souls, it actually comes from one later Christian theologian, Thomas Aquinas, in the 12th century. In fact, he had the idea that even women don't have any souls. You know, that's why women didn't have voting rights and everything, and that's why the women's liberation movement came up. But anyway, so he said, okay. So Prabhupada makes things very clear. You know, Prabhupada doesn't, you know, one of the defining characters of Prabhupada's preaching is that he makes things crystal clear. So the Christians have the idea there's a spirit but no soul. And so you ask, what is the difference between spirit and soul? They are not clear. So Prabhupada says, spirit, soul. The body is animated by the spirit soul. So it's very clear. So then he said, okay. Then he tried to change the subject. He said, you know, if you're worried about killing, then why do you... If you are worried about life, he argued, then why don't you do something about the embryos who are being killed in the womb? Why don't you stop? Why are you so worried about animals? You worry about humans who are being killed. I said, very good. So you are against abortion? He said, of course. I said, okay, what happens to the soul? What happens to the soul of the child who dies? Now, according to their idea, you know, every time a man and a woman conceive, a new soul is created. And that soul lives for his particular lifetime. And if he accepts Jesus as a savior, then he will go back to God. Then he will die, and at the time of judgment, he will be taken back to God. And if he doesn't, then he will go to hell. That is the idea for eternal damnation. So now their idea is a little problematic. For several centuries, Christian theologians have been trying to redefine the word eternal. The word eternal means no beginning and no end. But there, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 2.20 also, ajo nitya shashvato yam sharira. Ajo, that he has no beginning, unborn, and nitya, eternal, no end. But their idea is that the soul is that which has a beginning but no end. So it's like, you know, basically, eternity means infinity in the realm of time. It's infinity in the realm of time. So infinity cannot be one way. You cannot be finitely infinite. Isn't it that? That means you cannot say that it is eternal, but it begins now. It's a logical contradiction. But they try to say that eternal means that which has beginning but no end. That is eternal. So then I asked him, okay, fine. What happens to the soul of the child who is aborted? He said, does he go to God or does he go to hell? He says, no. Actually, he has not committed any sinful activities. So he goes back to God. Really? I said, yes, of course he goes back to God. And what is the goal of life? Well, it is to go back to God. Then why not abort everyone? Then he said, oh, no, that is not good. Yeah, but is it not good to go back to the kingdom of God? He said, yeah, that is good. So, our intention is not to minimize or deride any philosophy. But the fact is that from the philosophical point of view, the Christian theology is very incomplete. And the main reason why Christianity has spread is because they have that aggressive spirit of preaching. And more importantly is because in the Sanatana Dharma, we did not preach so effectively. The Judeo-Christian worldview, because of its limitations, and especially because they do not accept the idea of past lives, so they just cannot explain why there is suffering in this world. Especially why innocent children suffer, why innocent people die in tsunamis and earthquakes and natural calamities, in millions sometimes. And in fact, Darwin himself wanted to become a Christian priest, and he had joined a seminary to become a Christian priest. But when his daughter died of tuberculosis, the Christian theology gave him no answers. So he said, I cannot see this world as good. I see it as evil. You say there is benevolence, but I don't see any benevolence. You know, a lion attacks a deer and kills the deer. If you say that there's a design, on whose side is the designer? You know, the deer is designed to run away from the lion, and the lion is designed to catch the deer. So on whose side is the designer? He said, I just cannot see any good. I see only so much cruelty and suffering and evil in this world. So the scientific worldview spread because the religious worldview could not answer the fundamental questions of life. So, now we'll come to later about how the Bhagavat worldview answers this question. So, that is the monotheistic or the Christian worldview. Now, the Islamic worldview is something similar, although they are much more fundamentalist, much more exclusivistic in saying that our way is the only way. But basically, both of them come from the same roots. So, I won't go into that. Now, we have in India the impersonalistic worldview, the Mayavadi worldview. So, if you ask Shankaracharya or his followers, now, why did God create this world? The answer you'll get it? The question and answer both are meaningless. Because neither God exists nor this world exists. Nor you exist. Everything is non-existent. But then don't we perceive that everything exists? Oh, that is all because of Maya. No, your sense of I-ness, my sense of your-ness, it's all this is because of Maya. So, the only thing that exists is Brahman. But then what creates this illusion? Oh, that illusion is because of Maya. So does Maya exist or not? They say everything is one, but there is Brahman and there is Maya. So it's two, it's not one. So then does Maya exist or not? Oh, Maya is simultaneous, existent, non-existent, indefinite, all-pervading reality. Whatever that means. How can something be existent and non-existent? However, this Mayavad is very popular. As I said, there are some college students who have this quote on their t-shirt. I was an atheist till I discovered I was God. So basically, by this Mayavadi worldview, it titillates the false ego like anything. Okay, I cannot be the controller and enjoyer of this world, of small things and activity in this world. I will be God directly. And the result of that is that people just are not able to surrender to the real Lord and experience the higher taste of bhakti. So, sometimes we wonder why Srila Prabhupada is so strongly against impersonalists. It's primarily because that they deprive the innocent people of the higher taste. They deprive the innocent people of the higher taste. Because the Mayavadis don't reject bhakti. They subordinate bhakti to jnana. Yesterday I was telling in the Brahmachari class how when our devotees had first come to Jagannath Puri with Srila Prabhupada, at that time the Puri administrator said that the foreigners cannot enter Jagannath temple. Then Prabhupada said, tell them that, you know, what kind of principles you are following, how you are dedicated to preaching Krishna's mission. So then the Puri administrator said, you go and meet Shankaracharya. The Shankaracharya allows, then you can enter. So then when they went to meet Shankaracharya, Jayapataka Maharaj went, so he saw that right in the sort of reception room, this beautiful deity of Radha Krishna. So he was very surprised. This is Mayavadis and Radha Krishna deity. Then he remembered one conversation. Prabhupada said, when the Mayavadis get bored with their Mayavad, they worship Radha Krishna for a change. So then Shankaracharya came and then he explained the whole situation. Shankaracharya said, what you are doing is very good. You continue this. In your next life, you will be born in a Hindu family and then you can enter Jagannath temple. So, then as Jayapataka Maharaj was leaving, so he said, can I ask a question? He said, yes. How is it that you are following Shankaracharya who does not believe in form, and how is it that you are worshipping Radha Krishna? So, who is worshipping Radha Krishna? I am worshipping myself. This is Brahma, that is Brahma. Brahma arpanam brahma vir brahma agnav brahmana hutam brahmaivatena gantavyam brahma karma samadhina. So that is their idea. That's why what happens, the Mayavadis may appear to be exactly like bhaktas, but they actually don't have bhakti. And that's why when people hear Harikatha from them or Harikirtan from them, they cannot get higher taste. And because they cannot get higher taste, they stay stuck in the lower tastes. And that's why, although in India, religion is such a predominant part of life, but still, you know, Indians are so materialistic. Isn't it? It's so amazing if we try to preach to our non-devotee acquaintances and friends, the number one concern is money. Money and position and wealth. Now, they're religious. In In Chennai, there is a special temple of Ganesh called as Visa Ganesh Temple. What is Visa Ganesh? Like Ganesh is supposed to remove Vignanashak, to remove obstacles. So this form of Ganesh is supposed to remove the obstacles for going to America. So if you are not getting visa, then go and pray to Visa Ganesh. And you will get the visa. So it's very paradoxical that Indians are so religious and still so materialistic. Not materialistic in a very grossly sinful sense, that may be there in the younger generation, where they are becoming immoral. But even the older generation, it's paradoxically they're religious, but they're also materialistic. Why is that? Because their religion does not give them a higher taste. Because most of the religion in India is impersonalistic, so people don't get a higher taste, so then religion just becomes a means to get the lower taste. It means God becomes a factor to help us enjoy our material life better. So that's why this Mayavad is so unfortunate. Although it appears spiritual, it makes people more materialistic. And that's why Srila Prabhupada was so strongly against it. And that's why even when we hear Harikatha, it is called as Sarpo Chishta Yathapayam. The word Uchishta means remnants. Now in the Bhagavad Gita 17th chapter, while describing food in the three modes, Krishna says that Uchishtam apichamedyam, that he described that the food in the mode of ignorance, if somebody has eaten something and left, if we take it, that is considered tamogul. Now of course, if we take the Mahaprasad of devotees, exalted devotees, that is different. But generally, even the uchishta of a human being is considered tamasic and untouchable. Then what to speak of the uchishta of a snake? What to speak of the remnants of a snake? So if a snake touches some milk and then use it, it's poisonous. Although it's milk, it's poisonous. So like that, Harikatha, although it may be spoken in an apparently pure way, but actually it does not infuse devotion in the hearts of people. Now, you may say, if you go for some of these Bhagavad Kathas, you will find that people literally cry tears. And they do seem to be getting emotions. And sometimes they get more emotions than what we are getting in our Bhagavad Kathas. So you wonder, what is this emotion? So actually, there are mental emotions and there are spiritual emotions. So, bhakti pareshanubhava viraktiranyatracha. Bhakti is a science. And what does bhakti do? It gives us para isha anubhav. It gives us experience of God. And what is the result of that experience? That experience of God is so satisfying that viraktir anyatracha, that it leads to detachment from all other experiences. So people come to this Bhagavad Kathas and they hear about how Jatayu was killed by Ravana and they start crying tears. And they come back home and they turn on the television match and they see Sachin Tendulkar getting out zero and they'll cry tears again. So, there is no viraktir anyatracha. So, and because there is no viraktir anyatracha, we can understand that there is no para isha anubhav. There is no para isha anubhav. Why? Because, you know, people are not experiencing the higher taste. That's why India is religious, but it's still materialistic because due to the Mayavadi influence, people do not get much of higher taste. So, now, let's come to the Bhagavata worldview. The Bhagavata is monotheistic, but is not just monotheistic. Yes, there is one God, but he has many, many assistants. Sometimes people think of Hinduism as polytheistic, that there are many gods, but it's not like that. There is one God, but Krishna is so merciful that if out of our latent envy for him, if we are not ready to worship him, he allows alternatives for us. There are scripturally sanctioned alternatives for worship. So, in the other religions, that magnanimity of God is not manifest. Actually, it's remarkably magnanimous. Imagine if you are the owner of a company, you are the CEO or the owner of the company, and if somebody comes into your company and starts glorifying your assistant, your manager, somebody, oh, you are the CEO of the company. Now, for you to allow to do that, it requires a very broad heart. But Krishna allows that because you accept somebody as authority and rise higher. So, actually this whole system of demigod worship is a remarkable manifestation of Krishna's mercy. That Krishna wants to elevate us somehow or the other. Even if you can't surrender to me, you surrender to somebody else. And by that, you become elevated. And eventually, you will come to me. So, it's not polytheistic. Nor is it pantheistic. Pantheistic, everything is God. Everything, is everything God? Well, everything is God's. And God is present in everything. But everything is not God. As in the 7th chapter, Krishna says, 20th verse, Bahunam Janmanamante, Jnanavan Mam Prapadyate. Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samhatma Sudurlava. So it's very important words. Krishna says Vasudeva Sarvamiti. That God, Vasudeva is everything. But therefore, what should you do? He doesn't say therefore, Jnanavam Sarvam Prapadyate. He says Jnanavan Mam Prapadyate. You see the difference? Yes, God is everything, but that doesn't mean you surrender to everything. That means you surrender to God. Narasimha Dev came out of the pillar. Prahlad didn't go and worship the pillar. He worshipped Narasimha Dev. So, God is not everything. God is present in everything and God can manifest from everything. So, it's not that we worship everything. We worship God. So, one time one devotee asked Prabhupada, Prabhupada, when in the Bhagavatam we describe, we go and talk with the scholars and the intelligent people and we tell them that this Maharaj Ugrasen had millions and millions of servants and bodyguards. They don't believe us. So what should we do? So Prabhupada said, in the entire Bhagavatam, is that the only thing that you can tell people? So, the point is that actually the Bhagavatam contains a lot, but we should present in a way that people can develop faith. Now, one aspect of the ninth offense is to instruct a faithless person about the glories of the holy name. Means we should not tell people things which they cannot have faith in right now. We should systematically learn the philosophy by which they can develop faith. But of course, one aspect is indeed to understand that God has achintya shakti. He has inconceivable energy. I have this website, The Spiritual Scientist, where many times people ask me questions. So recently I got a question. There is, can God commit suicide? Just look at the tamasic, frustrated level of consciousness of the person. You know? So, you know, if I am feeling like committing suicide, I go and take shelter of God, I can be saved. But I'm thinking, will God commit suicide? So then I did a little study and I found that basically this question originates from skeptics who try to challenge God's omnipotence. They say, if you say God can do everything, they try to screw out things which God cannot do. And they try to prove, therefore, God cannot be omnipotent. So they say, God, can God make a square circle? Can God make a square circle? So now there are two kinds of impossibilities. There are practical impossibilities and there are logical impossibilities. Practical impossibility means what? Like, we say that Krishna lifted Govardhan. Now, for us, it's practically impossible. But, it's possible if somebody has sufficient strength. You know, if I lift this glass, if an ant is going along over there, how does he lift this glass? So, on the scale of the ant, the lifting the glass is practically impossible. But at another scale, lifting of the glass is possible. So, similarly, at our scale, lifting of Govardhan may be practically impossible. But at Krishna's scale, with his infinite strength, it is practically possible. So practically impossible can be made possible by Krishna. But what about that which is logically impossible? Like say this question of, can God make a round square circle or a circular square or whatever. All these things. So we have to understand that logic is not restricting God. Logic is what restricts our understanding of God. God has made this world to function in a logical way by which we can function and understand. You know, if everybody could start doing everything, we would not be able to function. Suddenly, say, once the devotee is sitting here and he flies away from here. If anybody starts doing anything, You know, if people's behaviors were not predictable, understandable, this world would be totally disorderly. So logic is something which God has made for us to understand and respond. Now logic does not restrict us. Logic does not restrict God. It restricts our understanding of God. So can God create a square circle? He can. But we will not understand it. Now Prabhupada gave the same answer. He said, can God make a stone which he cannot lift? So what did Prabhupada say? Yes, he will make the stone which he cannot lift and then he will lift it. So Jiva Goswami in the Krishna Sandarbha, one of the Sat Sandarbhas, he describes that God has Achintya Shakti. Now Achintya Shakti means, he gives a very important logic. He says if God is supreme, that means he has to be superior to our intelligence, superior to our logic. If we say whatever God does has to be according to my logic and my intelligence, then that means my logic and intelligence are supreme. God is not supreme. So God is supreme means that he is beyond our intelligence to understand. That is Achintya Shakti. And he gives several examples. So he gives two examples of how God is beyond our conception of space and beyond our conception of time. With respect to both, he used the example of Dwarka. He says, in Dwarka, according to material vision, Dwarka is actually 12 kroshas, 12 yojanas. 12 yojanas is one yojana is 8 miles, so 96 miles. But in Dwarka, every queen had a palace that was something like 6 kroshas. One krosha is 2 miles. And there are millions of palaces like this. Now from the logical point of view, if you have 96 square miles and there are 2 male palaces or 4 male palaces and millions like this, how can they fit in? So that is Krishna's Achintya Shakti. Krishna is not restricted by normal conceptions of space. And he also says that when Narad Muni went to Dwarka, he went to the different palaces of Krishna's queens. And we know that Krishna was present everywhere doing different things. But Jiva Goswami makes an interesting point further. He says that in some of the palaces, Krishna was doing the activities that are done in the morning. Like he was just waking up and praying and offering charity. In other places, he was doing activities which are to be done in the daytime, midday, taking lunch. And in some places, he was doing activities to be done in the evening. Now, it was not that Narad Muni went to one palace in the morning and second in the afternoon and third in the evening. He was going very fast. So, Krishna is not limited by our conceptions of time. It can be morning here, afternoon there, and evening there, and Krishna will be everywhere. So, this is the meaning of Achintya Shakti. Achintya means that which we cannot conceive. Now, if we say, if we cannot conceive, Achintya means, jiska chintan nahi kar sakte. So, some people ask, to chintan kare kyun fir? You know, if you cannot think of God, then why bother? Don't think about him only. No, the point is that we cannot, by our thinking, conquer him. But, by thinking about him, we become purified. We develop our love for him. So when the scriptures say that God is unknowable, what it means is that we cannot know him in totality. But we can know him enough by which we can love him. And the more we know him, the more our love for him increases. So of course knowledge is not the only thing. We also have to have service attitude, but knowledge is important. So that's why the Vedic understanding of God is so systematic, you know, by explaining how there are multiple levels of worship, how there is God who has a Brahma Jyoti, which is that impersonal and personal also reconciled, how God has Achintya Shakti by which he can do things which normally are not possible. So we also accept that material nature acts according to laws, as the scientists say. Krishna also says, Maya, he doesn't say that I intervene all the time in the world. As Paramatma, he does not. As Bhagawan, with respect to devotees, he does. But as Paramatma, Maya Adhyakshena Prakriti, I am overseeing, I am supervising. 9.10 and 13.23 says, Upadrashta Anumantacha, I am overseer and permitter. So this is what he basically does. So this understanding is so systematic and complete that it's Jayadvaita Maharaj in one interview was asked, you know, the television, why did you become a devotee? He said, the philosophy left me with no alternative. So the philosophy is so systematic that we just cannot escape. Unless, of course, we want to escape. So there is a saying, you know, the problem with this world is that the foolish are confident and the wise are doubtful. So materialistic people are so confident. If I just go to America, I will be happy in my life. But as devotees, we think, does Goloka really exist? We have doubts. You know, the foolish are confident and the wise are doubtful. So that brings us to the last part. Now, how we can accept this worldview as our worldview at a deeper level. Now, the Bhagavatam does talk about Manus. In the fifth canto, it also talks about the cosmology, which is very difficult to understand. But the essence of the Bhagavat worldview is that we are persons, God is a person, and we all can have a personal relationship with God. About 5-6 years ago, after the Delhi temple was inaugurated, Radha Parsarthi temple, there was an editorial in the Times of India, which was entitled The Rebirth of Krishna. And this editor, so I called him up afterwards to thank him for that role. He's based in Delhi. So he wrote a very interesting point. He said that, what is India's number one export commodity? You may say it is software engineers. So many people are going out. Or some people may say it is Indians who speak English, because Indians, you know, they are cheap labor and they also know English. But he says if you go to Cambodia, you go to Guatemala, you go to Cambodia, you won't find any software engineers. You won't find any Indians speaking English over there. But you will find Krishna temples over there and Krishna deities. So he said Krishna is India's number one export commodity. And who has exported this? He said it is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So it is quite an appreciative article. So he said a very interesting point. Why is it that ISKCON has spread so rapidly? He says the chief charm of ISKCON, ISKCON's philosophy, is in the promise of a personal relationship with a loving God. The promise of a personal relationship with a loving God. Yes. So that is what is the essence of our Bhagavat worldview, that all of us can have a relationship with God and we can develop that relationship. Now, developing that relationship has many aspects. We'll discuss three aspects. Now, one is we can deepen our relationship with Krishna, we can intensify our relationship with Krishna, and we can expand our relationship with Krishna. So deepening means in terms of philosophical conviction, in terms of realization, in terms of faith. So often as practicing sadhakas, one of the main reasons why we may develop some doubts because we find that the material desires keep pulling us. The material desires keep agitating us. And we are chanting, we are practicing spiritual life, and still we wonder, why is it so many years I am chanting, but still the material desires are pulling me. And that may sometimes create some doubts in our hearts. But if we think about it objectively, there are many material desires which chanting and Krishna consciousness have completely eradicated. For example, some of us might have been eating meat before we started practicing Krishna consciousness. But how many of us, now when we, if you're traveling on a train or a plane, if you see somebody else eating meat, how many of us feel tempted? Oh, I'm missing meat. You know, Yamunacharya says, I spit at the thought. No, we can do that at least with respect to meat. We don't feel any attraction. We feel, better let me go away from here. I will request that person, you please go away. So what happened to that desire? We had that desire a few years ago in this very lifetime. But that has gone away. How? That is the potency of the process of Krishna consciousness. So Krishna consciousness can remove our material desires. And we can all think of, meat is just one example, but we can all think of desires which are just evaporated by the power of Krishna consciousness. But many other desires, especially the desires for sensual pleasures, sexual pleasures, may not go away so easily. What is the reason? One reason is, of course, that they are very deep-rooted from many past lifetimes. But another more important reason is that we often keep titillating those desires. You see, the standard example that Prahlad Maharaj gives is of kandu tivan manasijam vishahe tadhiraha. That it's like a scratch, it's like an itch. So now, if we have an itch and if we stop scratching the ear, if we scratching that particular sore, and if we apply medicine, what will happen is the itch will go away. And that's what happened with respect to desires, like for the desires for meat eating. As soon as we started to practice Krishna, we just gave it up completely. And because we gave it up, that particular boil got cured. But with respect to many other desires, we apply the ointment and we keep scratching the itch also. We keep secretly, periodically scratching the itch. And because of that, it appears as if so many years I am chanting, but still the desire is still there. Yes, we are applying the medicine for so many years, but along with that, we are also scratching the itch. So, if so, Jayadit Maharaj was telling in one class, he says, what is this Star TV and internet? He says, it is all sick people scratching their itches and other people watching to become sick. That is Shastra Chakshu. That's a sadhu can see like that. So anyway, so actually, by thinking about those of our attachments which we have become free of, we can gain faith that Krishna consciousness can free us from other attachments also. And this way we can deepen our faith in Krishna consciousness. Now, param drishtva nivartate, Krishna says in 2.61. You get a higher taste, then you become steady. So we need faith in the process of Krishna consciousness. Now, that faith is not just that I am not the body and the soul. The faith is not just that there is God or Krishna is God or there is a spiritual world. At a practical level, that faith means the faith that the higher taste exists and that the higher taste is accessible to me. That first of all, there is a higher happiness that is available. And it's not that it is so far away that, yes, I believe it, but I will be enjoying the lower taste. No. The higher taste exists and the higher taste is accessible to me if I just endeavor for it. So that is a faith which we can get by associating with devotees who are fixed in that higher taste. And the more we try to free ourselves from the lower taste, the more we open ourselves to the higher taste. And the more we get that higher taste, then scriptural truth becomes like a experientially verified truth for us. Then our faith becomes unshakable. The difference between Shraddha and Nishtha, it described, is that when you go through anartha nivritti and come to Nishtha, Shraddha, our faith is like a banana tree. At Nishtha, it is like a banyan tree. Banana tree, anybody can come and shake. Banyan tree, even an elephant will shake, but the banyan tree will not shake. So like that, if we can go through anartha nivritti, our faith will become very strong. So we have to deepen our relationship with Krishna by philosophical conviction. Then we have to intensify our relationship with Krishna. Intensify is more in terms of emotions. All of us have our own mental homes. Mental homes means, where does our mind go to for rest? By default, all of us have physical home. Now what does the physical home mean? That means, after we may go out of the home for work, but as soon as that work gets over, we come back home. So home is a place where we return by default for rest and rejuvenation. So like that, all of us have a mental home. That means that is where by default our thoughts go to. Now for a pure devotee, that default home is Krishna. Dhautatma purusha Krishna padamulam namunchati mukta sarva pariklesha pantha swasharanam yatha. The second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam we describe. Pantha swasharanam yatha. Just as a traveler comes back to his home, a devotee always comes back to Krishna's lotus feet. For him, Krishna's lotus feet are his home. Aniketah sthirmatir. A pure devotee in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita described as one who has no home. Aniketa, but sthirmatir. His consciousness has found a home. A home at Krishna's lotus feet. Machitta madgata prana. While describing a pure devotee in the 10th chapter, 9th verse, Lord Prabhupada translates this machitta very interestingly. He doesn't say that the devotee thinks of me. He says the thoughts of my devotees reside in me. The thoughts of my devotees reside in me. That means for a devotee, Krishna is his mental home. Now for all of us, we have to think, what is our my mental home? For some of us, it may be sense objects. For some of us, it may be wealth. Some of us, maybe it may be prestige and position. And some of us, it may be just praise by others or whatever. All of us have our mental homes. And these are all mental homes which are false shelters. They will all fall. So Krishna consciousness is not just about changing the externals. We put on tilak and we wear a dress, we wear a kanti mala and tilak. That is important. But we have to change our internal home. And that process begins by trying to take shelter of Krishna wherever Krishna gives us that shelter. Like once I had asked Sonas Radhanath Maharaj this question that when kirtans are going on, should we try to take darshan of the deities, or should we try to close our eyes and try to hear the holy name, or should we try to absorb ourselves in dancing? So he said, whatever way you absorb yourself, whatever way you can absorb yourself, the principle is absorption. So Jayadvaita Maharaj asked in Pune, how do we become serious about Krishna consciousness? So he said, somehow or the other. So then he explained, he said, what that means is, whatever you like in Krishna consciousness, you become serious at least about that. You know, if you like kirtans, become serious about kirtans. If you like bhajans, become serious about bhajans. If you like philosophy, become serious about the philosophy. If you like a particular devotee, become serious about serving that devotee. And by that seriousness in at least one aspect of Krishna consciousness, through that one aspect we will get the higher taste. And that higher taste will lift us up. So we all have to have our mental homes. We are not, at least I'm a struggling sadhaka. So we have to find out where we can at least start building our Krishna conscious mental home. And gradually as we build it more and more, then we will give up our false mental homes. And then whenever there is distress, whenever there is difficulty, whenever there is anxiety, instead of falling prey to the lower temptations, we will go to our Krishna conscious mental home and take shelter and gain strength and move forward from there. So in his new book, The Yoga of Love, Sonas Radhanath Maharaj mentions very beautifully, what is enlightenment? So 3 points. He says, enlightenment, sometimes it's not enlightenment means suddenly a spark falls on your head and something you see. No. He says, enlightenment is a constant awareness of this world as inherently divine, of life as a loving partnership with God, and of every moment as an opportunity to offer and receive love. Very beautiful. Basically, there are 3 components of reality. There is Jiva, Ishwar, and Prakriti. So, we see Prakriti as divine. A constant awareness of this world as inherently divine. And we Ishwara of life as a loving partnership with God. And with other Jivas, of every moment as an opportunity to offer and receive love. That is how an enlightened person sees. Now, we may not have that vision right now, but we can try to cultivate that vision. Now, the process of Krishna consciousness is gradual. Just like if you are chanting in the mornings, you see it is dark, dark, dark. It's dark for some time. And then suddenly you see, oh, it's sunrise. Everywhere there is light. So now the sun was rising gradually, but our realization that the sun has risen is sudden. Like that, every day that you are practicing Krishna consciousness, the sun is rising. Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Karaye Udaye. Karaye Udaye is rising. But our realization will happen at one particular time. But we have to keep making sure that the sun keeps rising. So cultivating that vision. And that comes to a last part, is expanding our relationship with Krishna. Expanding means that comes by preaching Krishna consciousness. The more we give Krishna to others, the more Krishna gives himself to us. And that was Srila Prabhupada's infinite compassion. That even in his old age, he went from Vrindavan, the capital of devotion, to New York, the capital of degradation. For what? Just to give Krishna bhakti to others. And it is by his mercy that all of us have the opportunity to develop our relationship with Krishna and to share that relationship. Preaching is not just about speaking some philosophy, but it is about sharing our relationship with Krishna. Preaching means sharing our relationship with Krishna. That means that we, by our contemplation, by our realization, we feel that Krishna consciousness is so wonderful. Why should anyone else be deprived? Let me share this Krishna consciousness with others. And when we do that, then the more we try to practice this Bhagavata worldview and share that worldview with others, then what happens? Then we get the view of the other world. We can return back to the spiritual world. And we see so many of Srila Prabhupada's dedicated disciples actually leaving their lives wonderfully and then leaving their bodies in exemplary consciousness.
And that is the ultimate proof of the success of Krishna consciousness. That when we have to pass this final test, we have lived our lives in Krishna consciousness, Krishna will help us at that last moment to transcend whatever sufferings are there by our remembrance of his lotus feet. And thus, if we have built our mental home, our inner home, before that moment of death comes, then the death may hit our bodies, but our inner homes will be secure and our soul will be transferred to that inner home to be eternally with Krishna. I'll quickly summarize what we discussed. I started by talking about the importance of worldviews. I talked about the Bhagavata analogy of moths entering into fire and river entering into the ocean. Yes, devotees and non-devotees both will die. But the way devotees live and how they benefit the world and how they attain a wonderful destination afterward, that is different because their worldview is divine. Then we discussed about the scientific worldview. How trying to understand everything as happening by laws is dangerously incomplete. It may be partially correct, but we have guided missiles and misguided men. Then we discussed about the Christian worldview, the monotheistic worldview, philosophically very inadequate. Then we discussed about the monistic worldview, which actually seems to be religious, but because of not giving a higher taste, creates people who become more and more materialistic. Then we discuss about the Vaishnava worldview, how the Bhagavata worldview, how we have to, there are so many agents, like we have Manus over here, Devatas, they are all there to help us in our onward spiritual journey. If we cannot surrender to Krishna, Krishna gives us alternatives. And Krishna somehow helps us to elevate ourselves. And then lastly, we discuss how we can all deepen our relationship with Krishna by remembering how the process has worked in our life in the past and gain faith to make it work in the areas where it is not working right now. We can intensify our relationship with Krishna by creating our own mental homes in those activities where we get the shelter of Krishna, and we can expand our relationship by reaching Krishna consciousness. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.